Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 6:28 p.m. that is Pacific Summertime. Today is March 13th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I do apologize for the late recording. And I've had a couple of technical difficulties which have prolonged the ability to record. So back in action now, at least. Well, there are a number of different things on the S&P 500 that are worth considering, particularly against a background where fear has certainly risen over the last week. The first is that we certainly have the failed upside break above the 3,000 level. Rule of thumb from the chart seminar is that when the dynamic of the failure is larger than the dynamic of the breakout, it's going to go right back down and test the lower side of the range. That's exactly what's happened. It did so in an incredibly quick manner, going all the way down from under 3,500 to test the 2,500 point level yesterday. 2,500 points has been the lower side of the underlying trading range. So we're also right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And the 1,000-day moving average is a lodestone in terms of market reactions during secular bull markets. It doesn't really offer a lot of support during bear markets, but during secular bull markets, it does tend to offer support on a number of occasions during these medium-term corrections. It was not nearly as useful during the bubble phase between about 1995 and 1999, but it was certainly an indication that the bull market was over when the retracement to the 1,000-day moving average failed to find support there. What we often see, and it was equally true in 2000, was that when the market pulls back in a type 2 reaction, a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, then we'll often see that it encounters resistance in the region of the trend mean represented by the 200-day moving average. When it broke below the 1,000-day moving average, it rallied all the way back to test the 200-day moving average before then collapsing. Now let's go fast forward to what happened in 2007. Again, we had a type 2 reaction. Failed break to new highs in October of 2007, came straight back down to test the region of the trend of the lower side of the range, rebounded to the trend mean, pulled back to the 1,000-day moving average, rebounded to the 200-day moving average, and then broke down. And it then encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and then it really collapsed. Now let's go back and think about what's just happened. We've had a failed upside break. It has come straight back down to test the region of the 1,000-day moving average. If the kinds of peaks that have evolved since 2007 and 2000 are to be repeated, and they were both type 2 tops on the S&P 500, then the question is now whether we're not going to see a rebound back towards the 200-day moving average and subsequently an additional breakdown. That's what I would consider to be a worst-case scenario. What we are starting to see now, at least, is that the USA is marshalling forces to try and combat this spread of the coronavirus. So they're going to have drive-through testing in much the same way that South Korea has. But the other point, of course, is that the USA is a much larger country, and it is going to require substantially more tests. They reckon that, or at least President Trump mentioned the number of 5 million tests with it being available within the month. But that is about 1.5% of the population. So I think it is also worth considering that the infections are concentrated on the coasts rather than the center of the country, but nonetheless, the number of tests is going to have to massively increase because it has to give potential for people to be retested, And then it also has to give potential for people to be infected after they're tested. So this is obviously going to represent a rather lengthy period of difficulty. What it is also likely to result in is massive monetary and fiscal assistance. And in here this week, we've had ample evidence of that already. The pound, for example, has been falling the last few days because of the scale of assistance that the UK government is going to provide. 600 billion in infrastructure development is rather profound. 10-cent retracement in the pound is incredibly profound as well. And this is obviously now at risk of coming right down to test the 120 area. But the question is then, are we going to see it break down? The UK, it could well break down because the Johnson administration has taken a hands-off approach to trying to mitigate the consequences of the coronavirus. And unfortunately, that is not confidence-inducing, and they are talking about having 800,000 deaths. Well, that obviously is not confidence-inducing either. And the reality is that the NHS is going to be inundated if they don't quickly adopt social distancing. And closing the schools is one of the most obvious ways of doing that, because children, meeting children and being in close contact with one another and then spreading it to their parents is a primary route of transmission. That's an absolute no-brainer. But the UK hasn't adopted that measure yet, and every day that goes by, then that increases the potential for additional spread of the virus. So there is a reason why the UK, or the pound, is weak in here, and that is also likely to weigh on the FTSE 250, and it has now very clearly broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. There is, of course, the point that when you get these massive reactions against the prevailing trend, they're incredibly swift in terms of the pullback. And accelerations are trend endings. They're always trend endings. It's only of undetermined duration. The question, of course, is whether during any rebound, how far up is the rebound going to go? And I think this is the big question for a lot of people. It's how deleterious is the environment that we have right now going to be to economic growth? One thing that we certainly know right now is that when we think about the yield curve spread, it has been rising over the course of the last few days. It's doing so in a dynamic manner, and when we look at that on a longer term basis, it is generally when the yield curve spread surges higher after an inversion that we are on the front edge of a recession. So the clear conclusion here is that this pattern we have on the yield curve spread is virtually identical to what we had in 2007. And also very similar to what we had in 2000. So there is the clear potential here that we're going to see a significant steepening of the yield curve. And that is likely to be in response to considerable deflationary forces. And that is, I think, really what we can simply expect from the market, that growth in the first quarter is going to be very disappointing. Growth in the second quarter is probably going to be worse. And when we think about what the impact of that is going to be on businesses, well, any business that is highly levered is going to be under a great deal of duress. But it is primarily those companies that have been heavily dependent on access to liquidity are going to be under the most difficulties, because without customers, they're not going to be taking in income. Without economic activity. It's going to be difficult to sell their wares, and that means that their cash burn rate is going to go off the charts. Well, that's also part, well, it's not also, that is exactly the reason why companies like Uber and Lyft have been pulling back really very violently over the course of the last couple of weeks, going from over 40 to just over 20 in the space of approximately 1 month is a pretty profound decline. And of course, nobody is going to want to take these as long as there is even the remotest possibility that they're going to contract the virus. The one thing I've certainly seen over the last couple of days, and it's the primary reason that we decided to keep our kids out of school today before they finally announced in the latter part of the day that they were closing the schools, is the supermarkets are selling out of everything that can be stored in a fridge or is non-perishable. There is panic buying in all supermarkets. It's no longer about hand sanitizer. It's now about laying on as many reserves as possible to wait out a quarantine period, which is quite likely to be 2 weeks, but could potentially be longer. How does one decide to end a quarantine when there is still pe there are still people out there that are infected? That is when reliance on testing is so important, and trying to then identify people that are infected and quarantine them and then trace down their contacts. Singapore, in particular, has been particularly effective at tracing people's contacts via social media and their use of online apps like Grab or Uber. And there is no reason why that can't also be done in other countries. It just takes the will to do so. And that's one of the clearest, most disappointing things that the UK has failed to do. That it's within their grasp to try and trace contacts, and they're just giving up and not doing it. And that is something that is probably going to come back and bite the Conservatives very hard the next time there is an election. So we can anticipate there is definitely going to be a recession, and it is likely to be global in nature, and it is likely to put pressure on the banks on the one hand. So one thing that I think is important is that the TED spread has broken on the upside. And the TED spread is very, it's a very simple spread. It is the difference between LIBOR and at 3 month Treasury bills. So it's now up to 50 basis points. Now it has not yet broken so far on the upside that it is irretrievable. When we look at just what was happening back in 2007, then what we can really conclude here is that yes, there is upward pressure here, but we're not yet at anywhere close to the highs which we had back in the 2007 period, and certainly nothing like we had in 2008. But it is likely that we're going to see the TED spread right widening out to approximately 100 basis points. I think that is a reasonable expectation, considering the draw that we're currently getting on the in the banking sector. Last week, Sequoia told its partner companies to hoard cash and to cut back on spending now, because there is no point in trying to do that when cash is already scarce. Then we had in here this week both Blackstone and Citadel doing the same thing, and now we're also seeing companies like Boeing, the various airlines, and a range of other companies also drawing down on their credit lines. So Boeing has now completely erased the bull market since 2017. It was at $450 before planes started falling out of the sky, and it tested the $150 area today. It's obviously pricing in a lot of bad news. There's absolutely no question of that. But the reality is that and this is, I think, going to be a test case in MBA programs for the foreseeable future, is that a number of these industrial companies have hollowed out their industrial base by adopting a financialization of their balance sheet. And that's a real problem when you are creating machines that are supposed to transport people safely from A to B. When you're a military contractor and supposed to be designing products that can sustain a country during wartime, then it's rather important that they function correctly. Then those are should be the priorities, rather than trying to ensure that shareholders get paid their dividend, or that shares get bought back, or that senior executives get paid as significant share options. Now, unfortunately, those were the priorities of Boeing, and now we're seeing the results. So the share has collapsed over the course of the last 3 weeks. The problem, of course, is that with a major industrial like Boeing, they employ 161,000 people and hundreds of thousands more in their rather large supplier network. We can see, for example, that there are hundreds of companies that rely on Boeing for their livelihood. And when we think about companies like Spirit AeroSystems, where 79% of revenue comes from Boeing, we can think about all of these additional companies. Triumph Group at 34%. These are obviously going to be hurting because of the inability of Boeing to, on the one hand, certify the 737 MAX and subsequently to sell any planes. The hit to the airline sector is on par with 9/11. There was a week in after 9/11 when planes weren't flying, and it probably took a couple of weeks afterwards to get some of the traffic back up and running. But within a month, the traffic was back at its peak. It's probably going to take longer on this occasion, for the very simple reason that people are going to be quarantined for at least 2 weeks. They're going to be afraid to travel to countries that have had big breakouts. And they're going to want to see evidence from other people that they've been tested and that they're safe. So this is going to have a significant knock-on effect. The amount of business that gets done with in a person-to-person basis is really quite significant. The fact that Boeing is tapping on its revolving credit lines now, well, that tells us, obviously, that they're desperate for cash. But those revolving credit lines are not designed for all companies to tap on them at the same time, which is why the banking sector has been under such duress, and it has been pulling back in line with the market. But it was off its lows in here today, and we are very oversold in the short term. So we have to consider the potential here that some of the things that people are particularly worried about are liquidity. And the Federal Reserve in here over the last week has announced that they're going to make significant quantities of cash available via the repo market and via the balance sheet. So their balance sheet is quite likely to rise to approximately $6 trillion and potentially more than that. And we're really only at the beginning of that supply of liquidity. Now, one of the things that people are worried about is that the supply of liquidity is going to be a blunt force instrument in terms of what is required to tackle something like a viral outbreak. So what we can anticipate is that there are going to be significant additional measures to supplement the monetary and fiscal stimulus that are coming through from governments. We saw a taste of that from Donald Trump in here today, where he announced that not only will there be mobile testing facilities where people will be able to be tested in the car parks of the bigger stores, and that there will be additional fiscal stimulus, but that the interest on student loans will be paused for the foreseeable future. Now, that's something that's going to directly put money in people's pockets. And it's obviously something as well that will help to support his re-election campaign. But it is something that is very likely to be just the beginning of the kinds of supports we're likely to see. Rents and corporate rents have been rising for approximately a decade, and they are really quite high. I was talking with a real estate agent friend over the last couple of days. He was telling me that there was a supermarket near where he's living where the rent was approximately $150,000 a month, and it was raised to $200,000, so the supermarket closed and Amazon bought it. So they are now going to end up with an Amazon Fresh supermarket, but Amazon will pay the $200,000. Not every small business is capable of taking that kind of rent increase, and they are much less well able to take that kind of rent increase when there is nobody frequenting their business. This is particularly the case for restaurants. Restaurants generally tend to have rather large square footage, and they can pay their bills because of either because their legacy rents are low or because of footfall. Well, if you don't have the footfall, paying the rent on the restaurant is going to be difficult, particularly if you have to also pay wages for people that aren't working. Well, that is obviously a significant challenge. It is something that is going to become a major issue, and it also suggests that we are likely to see either tax holidays or leases being renegotiated, and some of the larger owners of property to decide that they are willing to offer a holiday in terms of lease obligations. Those are obviously going to be the kinds of negotiations that are going to go on during a recession in normal times, but when they are happening to such a large number of people, then obviously that is something that is going to have an effect. We're quite likely to see extraordinary measures taken, and this is simply taking us further down the road towards modern monetary theory, outright coordination between the fiscal and monetary authorities, and it isn't as if they have a choice. They have absolutely no choice in the matter. It is completely necessary that we have clear and extraordinary measures taken to try and support economies when this kind of deleterious effects are so obvious. Now, of course, we've had an extraordinarily panicky environment, and there are a substantial number of shares that are really very deeply oversold. So it is quite clear that we're going to have a rebound. There are going to be companies that are at risk of being downgraded into junk. I think we pretty much know what those are. The automotive companies are certainly at the top of that list, and they have pulled back really very sharply over the course of the last couple of weeks. And it's not really like a company like Ford hadn't been trending downwards for a significant period already. But even here, we have clear oversold conditions. There is going to obviously be a knock-on effect for tour companies and tourist companies like Disney, which rely on people visiting cinemas and visiting parks. So the share has pulled back violently from approximately $150 to $100. So a meaningful pullback. When we look at where the valuation is right now, it's still around $20. So this is a rather impressive decline, but not yet at clear value. Procter & Gamble is a highly defensive company, but the very clear loss of momentum, failed upside break, massive reaction against the prevailing trend signals that the bull market here is over, that we are quite likely to see the incredible compression in yield that has taken place to now start to expand once more. What I find interesting is to look at the dividend yields of some of these companies. I'm not sure why that didn't work, but we can, wait a sec, let me see if I can, there we go. If we simply look at the dividend yield for companies like the I'm really not being very articulate while I'm trying to create this yield chart. One thing we certainly know is that is the 3.5% level is an area where a number of these types of companies have tended to find support over time. And what we can then look at is the yield on something like Procter & Gamble has very quickly given us plenty of evidence that it has offered support for the share and resistance for the yield around 3.5% since at least 2009. It's currently at 2.6%, so it has a long way to fall to get back to the 3.5% level. But we've had meaningful moves in a significant number of the classical dividend aristocrat type companies. McDonald's is another example of a share that has tended to find support in the region of 3.5%, and it still has a long way to go to get there. Nestle is another example. Johnson & Johnson is another example. Well, what this also tells us is that the compression in their yields has been very closely tied to the contraction in treasury yields over the same time. One of the most interesting factors in the early part of this week, with today being the exception, was that the treasury yield has been rising at exactly the same time that bonds or that equities have been falling. And that is clear evidence of a liquidity squeeze. One of the primary reasons why we had such an enormous decline yesterday was because of a margin call. When you get these kinds of massive moves, highly levered traders come under extraordinary stress. They have to close their positions because they don't have the margin to post. That also creates a liquidity shock because they have to scramble for money to meet their margin calls. That is one of the reasons why we've had contagion in a large number of other assets. Not necessarily because there's anything particularly wrong with gold or silver or indeed Bitcoin, but because investors had to sell them in order to meet margin calls. That's also part of the reason why there's been a sell-off in bonds, because they had to be sold in order to meet those margin calls. But it also suggests that we're in a rather dicey situation with the global financial sector. With the TED spread starting to rise, with liquidity conditions in the repo market really quite acute, then there is going to be a clear mandate by the Fed to backstop the repo market. And that leaves them open to unlimited liability. They are selling $500 billion worth of three-month money in the repo market. They have upped their daily allocation to around $150 billion. That is going to massively increase the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. Europe finally seems to be of a mind to adopt fiscal stimulus. That is inevitable, that they were going to have to do it eventually. Now they have a clear catalyst to give them the political cover in order to adopt this. Germany announced that they're going to pursue a 600 billion euro infrastructure plan, and that they're going to set aside their fiscal conservatism over the foreseeable future. And that is completely necessary. The toll that the virus is taking on Italy is going to take a significant period to recover from, and not least because of the damage it's going to do to tourism. When Rome has to cancel church services, then we know that things are pretty dire. Well, we can pretty much conclude that there is going to be a recession, that people are now starting to look at bargains, but we are not yet at a cheap level for the vast majority of bigger companies. What I would be rather interested in seeing, unfortunately, it's rather difficult to get data on, is the number of companies that are still unicorns and what their liquidity situation is. Because one thing that we know for companies is that there are a substantial number that just don't make any money. And they have been able to survive because there has been such an enormous amount of money made available to them. So this is obviously something that we need to pay attention to. This is also, I think, an important chart. It was something that was circulated towards the end of last year, and it showed that margin debt had been declining while the stock market had been rising. And now those two figures are probably much better aligned. So that's, I think, an important consideration. We also know that corporate leverage is really very high and is back at levels that haven't really been seen in the investment grade sector since 2001. But because of the compression in yields since that time, then we have similar ratios available in the high yield sector. So we're in a very highly levered corporate sector. I think that the difficulties that Boeing is having, it might be an extraordinary case, but it is quite likely going to be a case study for a large number of other companies. The quantity of corporate leverage that has been taken on as a result of the low interest rate environment and the tendency to buy back shares is really quite stunning. When we then think about, well, what can we anticipate? There are obviously going to be two big camps. On the one hand, we can conclude that the massive stimulus that is in the pipeline, on a monetary, on a fiscal, and on a regulatory basis, is going to act as a very clear tailwind. On the other side, the extent of the fear and worry about the coronavirus is not about to be eradicated overnight. So that's also something that we need to bear in mind, that there is going to be a significant bearish trend. The most important thing right now is that we've had this reaction in the stock market, and jobless claims have not moved yet. Now, the next iteration here for March 7th, which is last week, is going to be on the 19th. We are going to have a significant number of important, I think, fundamental indicators updating at the end of next week. It's quite likely that jobless claims are going to rise. I think it's also worth remembering that when you have joblessness at decade lows, in fact, it's almost 50 years since joblessness has been at these levels, then the other conclusion, of course, is that it's very hard for it to get any better. And if it can't get better, well, maybe it can get worse. So I think that's something that we need to be prepared for. We also have to bear in mind that it's not simply the restaurants are going to be in trouble, but it's the low-end services sector has been where the vast majority of new jobs have come from during this economic expansion, and the slowdown from the coronavirus is going to hit those people hardest. So that is likely to result in an uptick in jobless claims. I think that's certainly one of the clear risks that we have, but we have to consider that that is part and parcel of a recession. The risk in the stock market is on corporate leverage, that with rising unemployment, fewer people working and spending, that it is going to put additional pressure on companies to continue to hire people, continue to spend, and that we will have a significant slowdown. The slowdown from the coronavirus is likely to last at least a couple of quarters, and potentially more than that. And the effectiveness and severity of the measures taken now will likely pay dividends in future. So, the more social distancing, the more testing, and the more economic trouble that is tolerated now, it will probably shorten the amount of time required to get the problem under control. I think the USA has probably finally come to that conclusion today, and the stock market is rallying on the back of that. The UK has not yet come to that conclusion, but I think it is inevitable that they will have to come to that conclusion. Then, when we look at other countries, well, Australia is obviously now also going to have a number of cases and a widening problem. The stock market was well off the lows in here today, and going from over 7,000 to 5,000 in the space of 3 weeks is an incredibly large move, and the speed of the decline is really incredibly stunning. With the government in Australia now moving towards a much more concerted effort to mitigate the spread of the virus, well, then that does leave room for some additional consolidation. The problem is that they're anticipating that anything up to 60 to 70% of the population are going to have the virus. And how is an economy supposed to function when half the people are quarantining themselves? And the other half probably also quarantining themselves because they don't want to be infected by the first half. So the dislocation in terms of the market is really likely to be really very considerable. I don't think that we can believe any of the statistics that are coming out of China, but one thing is clear. They appear to have given up on counting, or they're still counting and they're reclassifying deaths and infections in a different way. Anyone who's coming in with flu-like symptoms is being categorized as flu. If you come in with renal failure, regardless of whether it is because of the coronavirus, well, then you're a kidney patient. If you're coming in with complications because of diabetes, then you're a diabetes patient. You're no longer a coronavirus patient. And they are not counting mild infections at all. Well, China appears to be willing to tolerate the risk that a significant proportion of their elderly community is going to die. Unfortunately, that would also be what the UK appears to be willing to do. I mean, I'm not someone who is gets angry very often, but I'm simply agog at the cavalier attitude that the UK government is taking towards its citizens. When we look at the Chinese market, it is definitely getting support from the Chinese government, and it has been a very calm place compared to the extraordinary volatility that we have everywhere else. Well, they are still importing iron ore, and the stocks of iron ore that they're building up are just epic in proportions. They are preparing to engage in a massive infrastructure build. So when we start to tot things up, the UK, Germany, and China have all announced massive infrastructure builds over the course of the next while. Obviously, they're going to have to get over the coronavirus first, but then the stimulus that is going to be put in place to reinvigorate the global economy is going to be absolutely epic in proportion. Well, that suggests that yes, there is still potential for trouble in the corporate sector. There is likely to be a lot of leverage squeezed out of the system, and that could yet contribute to markets moving on to new lows. When we look at the consistency of the S&P 500 in particular, it has lost it because it has now had a massive failed upside break, and it's never had one of those in the context of the decade-long bull market. The Nasdaq 100 has also had a failed upside break, but it has rebounded in here today. So it is still in the region of the upper side of its underlying trading range. The exposure that the big cloud companies like Microsoft, Apple, or Amazon, and Google have to the smaller loss-making companies is really quite acute. So Amazon was up $100 in here today, and it is still holding the lower side of the range that's persisted for the last year. As long as it's doing that, then the buy the dip crowd are still going to be placated. And this has been the buy the dip share in the context of the entire bull market. So as long as it's holding the low from yesterday, then we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to ranging. But there is a real possibility this is an evolving type 3 top formation. We certainly have the ranging time and size. And the volatility we've had over the course of the last 2 years is completely out of character with everything we'd seen previously. When we then think about the log scale chart, because a lot of the people buying Amazon will have done so on just an absolute basis rather than leverage. Well, we can then see that the size of the pullbacks have been relatively similar in percentage terms. We can also now see that the region of the 200-week moving average, that's the 1,000-day moving average, is approximating the lower side of the range around the region of the 2018 low. A sustained move below the 1,000-day moving average would signal top formation completion. So we're certainly at a very touch-and-go area with Amazon. The problem for a lot of these companies is that we are going to see some of the most overburdened app-based companies go bust. There are a significant number of people who bought houses to rent them on Airbnb, and it is likely they're going to start becoming delinquent on their loans. What this also suggests is that the massive amount of dry powder that the private equity sector has is going to be deployed in this recession, and the number of homes owned by private equity is likely to increase substantially during any recession that unfolds. They have the cash available. They have been waiting for this kind of development for years, and they're going to deploy their cash in anything that has got a potential for yield. What I find rather interesting is that during the worst of the decline, we've certainly seen that the solar sector has pulled back. but it hasn't pulled back by nearly the same extent as other sectors. And part of the reason for that is because a number of the companies in the sector come with the ability to lever the very low interest rate environment into a long string of cash flows. When then we look at the wind sector, it has also pulled back, but again, it is not down so much that it can't recover. We also have to think about, there's a lot of money being set aside for infrastructure development, but what is it that they're going to build? It's quite likely we're going to see a lot of dams and a lot of roads replaced, but then a lot of power generating infrastructure is reaching the end of its useful life, and it's going to have to be replaced as well. So that is a significant potential outcome from the panic about the coronavirus. Now, when we look at the gold price, it has been down in a dynamic manner 2 days in a row. It is now right in the region of the trend mean. It was really quite overextended relative to the trend mean, and we have a really rather large downside weekly key reversal in here this week. It's going to have to hold the $1,400 area if the breakout from the six-year base is to be sustained. I do think that it is more likely than not that gold is going to hold this breakout, because the range of options that are being explored to support the economy as a result of the coronavirus are all aimed at devaluing the currency. The primary reason I believe that gold was sold off this week was because of contagion and because of the need to raise cash where one could find it. But in the kind of deflationary environment that is about to unfold on the global economy, it is exactly the kind of environment where gold should perform. Then we have the incredible volatility that we saw on Bitcoin over the last 2 days, where it halved in the space of 2 days and then rebounded by nearly 50% in here today. So Bitcoin has historically been thought of as a potential safe haven, but certainly an uncorrelated asset. The only time when uncorrelated assets go to a correlation of one with everything else is during times of contagion. And that's exactly what we've had over the course of the last 2 days. The most important thing to bear in mind is that following contagion, it is the instruments that bounce first and subsequently continue to hold their lows and improve upon that in the ensuing recessionary environment are generally those that are going to lead up and out of the recession. So Bitcoin rallying in here today is important, but its ability to hold the low will be much more important if the more bullish phenomenon that could potentially be an outcome come to fruition. I think it's exactly the same with the renewables sector. We have still got a lot of overleverage in the corporate sector, and there are a significant number of bonds that are liable to be downgraded into the junk sector. So junk bond yields or high yield spreads are now up to about 750 basis points, and this is about where they have tended to find support over the course of the last decade. There is obviously the question that following some consolidation, are we going to see the breakout, or are we in fact going to see these spreads come all the way back down? I believe that since we are only at the dawn of a recession, that there is ample scope for the corporate spreads to widen out, for the simple reason that we haven't yet seen an uptick in unemployment. we have not yet seen people losing their jobs, which feeds through into their ability to pay their debts. There is obviously a chain of events that occurs before it starts to show up in corporate balance sheets. It can be anything up to a few months. Well, we've definitely seen the knee-jerk reaction. There was, I think, the easiest way to think about where the risk resides is to look at everything that people were worried about a year ago and just to conclude that the coronavirus makes it worse. So, in the USA, one of the biggest concerns has been the rather parlous state of some of the the states in their ability to meet pension obligations. Obviously, this is going to make it worse. So they're either going to be bailed out, they're going to have to refinance, they're going to have to or renegotiate their debt. I've talked a little bit already about the over leverage in the corporate sector and the hollowing out of corporate balance sheets and through financialization. Well, obviously, that is also a risk if we continue to see bond yields rising. Then, when we move on to Europe, there is the obvious problem about having so many different fiscal policies and one monetary authority, and there is the continued stress between the creditor and the debtor nations. That is eventually likely to create the need for further cohesion in order to smoothen out those differences, but that is a very long road to travel. And meanwhile, economic growth is likely to take a significant hit. Well, when we then think about the oil sector, crude oil is the subject of a very significant trade war between Saudi Arabia and Russia. It's pretty much going to put a cap on the ability of the price to rally. Certainly, the moves by both the USA and China to supplement their strategic reserves should help to put a floor under the market, or at least a partial floor under the market. But you need increasing demand from the wider global economy in order to sap up the additional supply that's coming down the pipe. So we're likely to see oil prices volatile for the foreseeable future and having a rather difficult time of sustaining a move above $50 for the rest of the year. Well, of course, we're kind of at the lower side of the range, so a move from 30 to 50 is still a rather significant pop on the upside. Natural gas has been trending down now for really quite some time, but what we did see in here this week was some strength starting to come through, and really through through all of the week, and we had the upside key and follow through on Monday and Tuesday. So it suggests that we have a low of at least near-term significance around the 160 level. Low energy prices are certainly something that are going to act as a tailwind to economic activity once people start to, in fact, start driving around again. So we are certainly being presented with more potential opportunities, a great deal of uncertainty, the virtual certainty that we're going to have a recession. And the problem with a recession is that it will start to put some of the most over-levered creditors in duress. That is a well-understood fact. So there is the potential that we're going to see very extraordinary measures implemented to tackle it. In the meantime, we are very oversold in the short term. There is the clear potential we're going to see a further rally. The most important thing to monitor, I believe, with the S&P 500 is its ability to sustain a move back above the 200-day moving average. If this is another medium-term correction, similar to what we had in 2011 are 2015 and 16 and 2018, it will be able to sustain a move back above the 200-day moving average and subsequently improve upon that performance and push back up to new all-time highs. If, on the other hand, it starts to encounter resistance in the region of the 200-day MA and drops back below the 1,000-day moving average, well, then we have categorical proof that a top has been completed. Now, when we look at the Dow Gold ratio, I think we've had a very meaningful change in the ratio over the course of the last couple of years. It had been trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner from the low in 2011, and since 2018 it has been holding this sequence of lower valley highs. Well, we certainly have a short-term oversold condition, and I think it is quite likely that this ratio should have turned around in here today. We certainly haven't had it updating yet, so I'm not entirely sure why that is, but it's quite likely that we're going to see gold continuing to have a pattern of outperformance over the medium term because of the willingness of governments to flog their currencies in service to trying to stoke nominal economic growth. That, I think, is something that we need to pay attention to, because gold certainly was not immune from a pullback in 2008, but it did go up nearly three times from the lows during 2008 to its peak in 2011, and that was a massive outperformance relative to the wider market. So it is certainly a sector that we need to pay attention to. The other important point is that technological innovation is not going to be derailed because of the coronavirus. We may see companies performing less efficiently. We certainly might see the pace of innovation moderate for a period of time. But the additional point is that the technology sector moves to its own drumbeat and not necessarily in tune with the monetary cycle. That does suggest that we do need to pay attention to technological innovation. There are going to be companies that are going to come out of this problem in much stronger positions. The other point, though, is that the reliance of some of the big companies on unprofitable small companies suggests that they are less likely to be the clear outperformers in the next cycle. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.